Hello, everyone. I'm Reinhard Wolf, and this is Red Ice Radio. Since Henrik and Lana are currently in Sweden for the Identitarian Ideas Conference, they asked me to host a few shows in their absence. The live stream for the event can be found on our YouTube channel, so definitely be sure to check it out. Our guest for today is Ryan Falk. Ryan runs the AlternativeHypothesis.com, where he writes about race realism, nationalism, and social issues. We'll be discussing what he refers to as First Worldism, which is an ideology focused on preserving the policies, values, and genetics of First World nations. Thanks for coming on, Ryan. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Great to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, including how you came to be red-pilled?
Okay. I've been around, like, in terms of what's relevant to the audience here. I the first thing I did that was like pseudo white nationalist anything, was back in 2007 when I made some videos on race and IQ. It started off with having read the Bell Curve, and you know, I still held to a lot of libertarian morality at the time. And I sort of imagined that race differences wouldn't really matter a whole lot in a world of small government. And what changed was then I became a little bit more self-aware that this sort of live and let live attitude, this is kind of a white fantasy, right? Because that's what white people are like. And white people tend to have this live and let live attitude, and white people are actually the weird ones in this regard. And just hoping that everyone else is going to behave that way and adopt the sort of live and let live ideals. Right, this was the essence of libertarianism, which I was at the time. And you know, libertarians might not say that. They might not say that having other groups also adopt the live and let live idea is the essence of libertarianism. But that is what is most important. So that's what it is, sort of in essence. But also, why should we make ourselves slaves to these other groups? You know, why should, you know, our liberty be dependent on the hope that, you know, these other groups will adopt libertarian ideals? So that was sort of like the first thought. And from there, my thought was, okay, and this is from the perspective of libertarianism. From then, my first thought is that there is no reason to open the borders to anyone when you don't have any way of guaranteeing what kind of views on government the people who are coming in are going to have.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah. So if you don't know what they're going to do, like, why are you giving them some sort of access to your stuff? It's like, hey, let's bring a whole bunch of people into our apartment. Oh, by the way, they all get votes on how the apartment is run. You wouldn't do that in any other context.
Nope.
Right. But when we have countries, it's sort of abstract, it's sort of far away, and it sort of gets sort of papered over in people's minds. But the thing is, I also had sort of a genetic bias, and this is just me talking about me here. I had a genetic bias in traits that is that came from reading a whole bunch of vegetarian stuff after, you know, Charles Murray. You know, I started to see, I had read other research, like from Bouchard, not just on race, but on all sorts of stuff. Found that basically, there's a 2004 paper from Bouchard that I forgot the name of, but basically what it should have been called is the Iron Law of Heritability. That's what it should have been called. He doesn't use that term, but that's basically what he's describing. Every psychological trait, every general psychological trait is to some degree heritable. And what I did, and when you look at, you know, big five personality traits, that's about 0.55 heritable. And this is based on twin studies. And, you know, even going down to political ideology. So, then you have these really obvious difference in the kinds of civilizations that are created in Latin America, you know, or kind of an Iberian Amerindian hybrid population. You have the kinds of civilizations that Africans make, the kind of civilizations Western Europeans versus Eastern Europeans make, you know, what I call Oriental Caucasian, Southeast and Northeast Asians, and Australian Aborigines. So And so when I was really young, I would read atlases. Like, I would go to the library and I would read atlases. So in my mind, I have a very good understanding of the economic, the relative GDPs and relative populations of the world, kind of a intuitive sort of off the bat understanding of the relative GDPs and populations of countries in the world from the year 1998, basically. So,
nice. That's a lot of information.
Yeah, but it was like I can tell you, like, I have a very good, like, I know the relative wealths and populations of countries from 1998. That's pretty relevant today, but not entirely. Like, obviously China's a lot more important now. So the thing about that is, like, I knew back then that, like, all African countries were a certain way, with like a little exception, like Botswana is like a little exception. South Africa is an exception, but there's a pretty obvious reason why South Africa would be richer than the rest.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, I also knew about Haiti, you know, and like, well, Haiti, that's not in Africa. In fact, it's literally on the same island with that Latin American sort of Iberian Amerindian mix on the other half of the island. Right. And at the time, you know, like I think, I forget the relative numbers, but, you know, Haiti, it's about 1700 per capita, and the Dominican Republic is about 11,000 per capita. Right. It's similar. Dominican Republic is similar to the rest of Latin America, which makes sense because it's filled with Latin Americans. And so, so much of libertarianism, and I'm talking about libertarianism here because that's relevant to me, but really any currently popular worldview that is multiracial, it's all dependent on other races as a whole, not just select individuals, but groups as a whole, behaving in a way that they have never behaved before. All right, and that may seem sort of profound, that may seem like too much, for me to say, but break it down. You know, when they say, oh, we're going to bring in, Arabs into Europe and they're going to, you know, have all these tolerant values about homosexuals, they're going to have these tolerant values about women, they're not going to vote in their ethnic interests, they're going to vote, you know, sort of based on ideals.
Yeah, right? They're going to become individualists, right?
Yeah, they're going to become individualists like us, because that's what we are, right? And it's this very, ironically, it's a very Eurocentric view of the rest of the world. You know, it is a Europomorphizing these other groups.
This seems to be the big mission of, the modern West, and I think it's been that way for quite some time. It's the idea that we can make other people like us. And I think there's almost kind of an ethical quandary there. Is it even ethical for us to kind of, you know, erase someone else's culture and then make them, you know, secular Western liberals?
But they don't.
Go on.
Yeah, but see, they don't even see it that way. Like, they don't. Like what you're doing is you're looking at what they're actually doing, okay?
Right.
But what they think they're doing is just bringing out the true Islam. Right, that's what
right.
they say they're doing. They don't think, oh, we're gonna erase, you know, the real shit that is Islam. Right? They don't say that. They think, oh, you know, the idea that Islam is crap, that's anti-Muslim, anti-brown people propaganda. The real Muslims are like us.
Yeah, or real Muslims are like their next door neighbor who's Muslim in name, maybe goes to, you know, reads the Quran every now and then and ignores half of it, like Starbucks and iPhones and so forth. That's the real Islam, right?
Yeah, the real Islam is my friend who lives in who lives next to me in my neighborhood.
Community, yeah.
In my neighborhood, where the average house price is $300,000, you know. So,
I've seen the talking point too that Islamic terrorism and radical Islamists are, overwhelmingly uneducated. They don't know what's going on. Right. And I've also seen evidence.
Which is not true.
The contrary,
say that. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, go ahead. Continue.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, let's talk about your, I don't know if you wanted to continue with where you were going there, or we could talk about your site.
Yeah. Well, okay, one last thing I think I would want to say is that like, even if we don't know anything about, like, say, the heritability of psychological traits, like, say we know nothing, we have zero knowledge, like, the burden of proof has to be on the person advocating multiracial states, because they're advocating the new thing that, to the extent it has been implemented, doesn't work. Like, for example, in the U.S., blacks and Hispanics in the U.S. could not sustain the U.S. just from a financial accounting standpoint. Like, right now, like, in terms of, like, the deficit, the annual deficit would not exist if the U.S. was, like, all white people just from an accounting standpoint. Now, Lulbergs, they'll come in and say, well, these black and Hispanic populations, they actually fill out the lower jobs and boost whites up, so whites have a higher income than they would have had if not for all these. But, of course, if you look at region data based on, you know, basically whites in regions that have more blacks and Hispanics don't make more money. Whites in European countries that have more, you know, blacks and Arabs and they don't make more money. So that's all BS as well. So, you know, like, white nationalism they sort of treat it like it's the thing to be proven, but really, like, white nationalism is just the norm, is the norm of European civilization, and of course racial nationalism of all types is the
right
thing for everyone else. Right? I mean, white nationalism, you know, created the Industrial Revolution. Like, that's, like, it was all these white nationalist states and regimes. I mean, frankly, they were even more narrow than just white. It was, you know, being white, that's step one. Step two is you have to believe all these things, you know, that are English and Christian and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And white nationalism created a confederation of empires that took over the whole world with the exception of, you know, the Northeast Asians, China and Japan and Korea. So, and even there had a great deal of influence. So even if you think all these differences in racial groups are purely environmental, you know, I obviously disagree with that, and I have some articles coming up, you know, arguing against that. But even if you think all racial differences are purely environmental, well, you know, you still have to show that you know how to change it, one, and to point to some sort of process by which you can Europeanize all these immigrants coming into France and Britain or whatever, but also that those policies to Europeanize them will be in place once you plan on importing them. So even if you take a purely environmental view of all race differences from a policy standpoint, you know, the burden of proof still has to be on the people proposing this new multiracial program. And so that's sort of how it started. And I think because I was a libertarian, I looked at a libertarian program, right? And so I was analyzing from the point of view of the libertarian program is X, Y, and Z, and part of that is, you know, and part of what a lot of people ascribe to being a libertarian is open borders. And so now when I think about, you know, the Republican Party or conservatism or what people call themselves progressives, I look at that as a program that includes a multiracial state, right? And so and once I saw that is insane, that's sort of what led me to stop decoupling race from ideology.
Yeah, very interesting, definitely. So let's talk about your site, The Alternative Hypothesis. Can you tell us what inspired you to create it, what its mission is, and what some of the topics that it covers?
Okay, it started out because what Sean and I wanted was a place that we could put all of our stuff. Sean and I, we were YouTubers. We were big on YouTube. And we would make YouTube videos, and we would source YouTube videos and stuff like that. And that was, you know, cool. And then we started writing for a little bit for the right stuff. But a whole bunch of people write on the right stuff. And there's articles coming on the right stuff all the time. You know, there's just a ton and ton of content. And so we just wanted a place to put all of our articles. And it would all be organized, and it would have answers to everything that we found ourselves debating about, right? We could just say, oh, here's the article for that, you know, cut, cut, cut.
Yeah.
instead of it being in our all of our bookmarks folders on our page, we could just point to an article. Like for example, stereotype threat. It's like, you know, we like there's an article on that, and I know the article is sound because I wrote it. I read every source that goes into that article. I understand what the article says. Whereas if you link to something that someone else wrote, they can write something where you agree with 90% of it, but then they can go off and say something you don't agree with it, and you find the person you linked it to saying, well, this person says this in the article, and that goes against what, you know. But if it's your article, you never have those problems.
Right. And I remember seeing something that either you or Sean said about, because you guys used to write for TRS, maybe you still do. I think part of it was that, you know, TRS has like a lot of like funnier but definitely edgier content. So if you're like in a serious debate with someone, you didn't want to send them to a website that has like, you know, Holocaust jokes on like the front page and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a riot. In fact, I think...
Oh, yeah, I love TRS, but I understand why you would do that.
I mean, I freaking think Daily Stormer is an actually a very smart website.
Yeah, but, I agree.
But you know, there's just sort of an initial revulsion. And quite frankly, there's certain people that, even when you link to the alternative hypothesis, they'll look at that, they'll look at the site and go, this has, you know, this is a racist website.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So even the alt-hype is like, you know... But there's always going to be people like that, and there's not really anything you can do about
that. Yeah, because they're just repulsed by, you know, the ideas, ultimately. You can have a very innocuous aesthetic and present things in a very reasonable manner, but if the ideas are wrong-think, then, you know, a lot of people are just going to, you know, put up the stop sign and refuse to go any further.
If they are militantly opposed to being neurotypical for all of world history, most of white history, then, you know, they're just going to continue with their mental illness and suppressions of their own survival instincts.
Right.
And another thing we wanted to do, and this may have been like we sort of said this like half tongue in cheek, so half jokingly, wanted to I don't know if I should even say this, but we wanted to sort of like try to improve alt-right argumentation generally, like by sort of popularizing the articles on the site in an easily digestible way, like specifically like stereotype threat. Like most people on the alt-right don't know all like the details of stereotype threat, and if you have that, that's like really, you know, bam, you know, if someone brings up stereotype threat and you can easily shut them down, that really raises your morale and lowers theirs. We'll just put it that way. So that's kind of what one of the things that we were planning on doing. Although as with most things, as the site started to develop, you know, we started it for some reason. Like, the reason you start something are not necessarily the reasons you continue doing it. And so right now, I write for it because I want to write for it. And there's an audience there, you know. That's basically
kind
why.
Kind of the gist of it. Okay.
It's kind of the gist of it, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, well, you've mentioned stereotype threat a few times. And without getting, you know, too off on a tangent, I think it'd be good to kind of explain what you mean by that. I have a pretty decent understanding of it, but for our listeners, why don't you just kind of briefly explain what that means?
Okay, stereotype threat is basically like, the argument goes like this. The argument is, there's a stereotype that black people are stupid. So when you give them a test, like even though they're not stupid, when they take the test, they're going to do poorly on the test because they're going to be like, oh, there's a test here, you know, basically test anxiety, right? Because, oh, I'm black, that means I'm stupid, that means I'm going to do bad on this test, and so they do bad on the test. That's the idea of it. And, I mean, do you want me to go into, like, the first study that established it, and then, like, why, you know, it's probably wrong based on natural experiments? Because there was a pilot.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, sure. I'll go. I'll talk about stereotype then. All right. So Claude Steele back in 94, 95, he did the pilot study, and it was at and what it did is it took a bunch of college kids, and they were matched for their SAT scores going in to taking a little IQ test in a room, and put them in a room, and they, so these guys had roughly the same IQs going in based on the SAT scores. SAT roughly corresponds with IQ. When you have a large number of people, it's going to be the same as IQ, whatever. So they were matched going in for the baseline scores. And so one condition was the no stereotype threat condition. Both black students and white students scored about the same. The next condition was the stereotype threat condition, and all it was they asked them about their race, and I don't believe there was anything else, and the black students did worse in the second condition. Now, and so he looked at that and that was like the what set off the excitement,
right?
That this explained, you know, the gap, because all they did was ask them about their race. Now, suspicion that the black students in the experimental condition knew what the experimenters wanted and conformed to that, but that's kind of, you know.
That's hard to prove, but it's hard to prove. Very possible.
You know, but the problem is there have been natural experiments since then. And, of course, like, it's difficult to do, like, a real-world experiment of stereotype threat, because that would never get past ethics, because basically you're saying, well, these people would score worse on the SAT if stereotype threat theory were true, right? So they couldn't do like a real experiment. But there have been natural experiments where the question going into taking the test was not standardized. Like sometimes they would ask you your gender, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they would ask you your race, sometimes they wouldn't. Okay, so it was non-standardized. And because it was non-standardized, you'd have one group where they had the stereotype threat prime and one group where they didn't. And there was one with the like a AP calculus thing. One had to do with a community college placement test, and another had to do with NAEP stuff. And in all three cases, the effect of the prime in the real world didn't matter at all. So that's one issue. The second issue is that there was also a study that looked at stereotype threat and test scores based on whether or not they paid the person. And what was funny is that they could produce a stereotype threat effect if they didn't pay the subjects. But then they started paying the subjects, and there was no stereotype threat effect if they paid. If they paid you for getting a high score. So if there was money on the line, your score never went down, which sort of ties into the other natural experiments where, you know, your class placement is on the line. Like, you don't want to be stuck in stupid classes, so you want to do well on the test. So there's that. There's also a problem with replication, right? Stereotype threat effects in the labs, they're only replicated about 30% of the time, or 58.4% of the time. It's complicated, like what is replicated and what is not. Basically, for the layman, it's only replicated about half the time. They're only able to produce a stereotype threat effect in a lab about half the time. That's another issue.
Okay.
Another issue is publication bias, you know, the file drawer effect. Basically, some people, one of whom was Jelt Wichertz, who was a hardcore race-denying person, but to his credit, he found a whole bunch of unpublished stereotype threat papers and found that, like, almost all of them showed no effect.
Right.
Which
total coincidence, right?
Well, yeah. And so he concluded that there is a big bias in stereotype threat literature to only to publish confirming studies.
Right.
Now, obviously, there have been some studies published that went against that, you know, there have been replication attempt failures that have been published. So it's not like negative results are never published. But the fact that all the studies that aren't published, or almost all of them, are negative results is highly suspicious. So yeah, and I could also get into the predictive validity of prior baselines. I could get into you know, how these groups do in college, and how, you know, these tests predict equally for IQ, for income. And so, like, if there was a stereotype threat effect on these tests, well, the stereotype threat effect in the real world just so happens to mimic all the other predictive capacities.
Right.
So basically, the rest of society is just as biased as the test. As
yeah,
the
and the average liberal would, you know, adamantly claim. No, you don't think so?
No, I think some would. Some of the more extreme would. But
yeah.
but I think the average quote unquote liberal you talk to on Facebook would.
Okay. Yeah.
But the average one in real life who's just trying to make sense of the world but doesn't have a lot of time to do it, you know, that's the typical quote unquote.
Well, it's really hard to make sense of the world when you fail to take in IQ difference, honestly. Because when I hear stereotype threat, that it's just further, it's just another example of people on the left or people who, you know, tend towards, the environmental explanations for human differences. They're just grasping at straws, trying to find some explanation for why groups do differently that isn't IQ, because we already know that IQ is on a group level, a very good predictor for success, and it does correlate quite well with, on a racial level for racial success. So if you just completely, take that out of the picture, then the world is going to look, is going to be very bewildering and confusing, and you're going to, end up, resorting to stereotype threat or some other such nonsense.
Right. Well, that's in 1965, like before the Civil Rights Act, they could always say, "Well, look, segregation." And that's another thing I go in articles on the site is deconstructing the myth that segregation was this horrible, oppressive thing, or that differences in school funding were a big deal, or whatever. But that aside, back in 1965, they sort of had something they could point to. They could point to segregation. But it's been 52 years, some people who know a lot, they'll say, well, actually, Ryan, the full-scale black white IQ gap has narrowed. That's actually a debatable point. But it's also kind of irrelevant. But I don't. It's irrelevant because I don't want to say this. I'm going off on tangents here. Basically, they had the segregation explanation hasn't really worked. And so now they're trying to do more and more esoteric and exotic explanations for these differences. And that's
right.
and it's getting crazier. It's getting crazier and crazier. So basically, I made a little picture to Sargon of Akkad on the Twitter, and Sargon, one thing he says is that, like, you know, there's similarities between social justice warriors and the alt-right.
Yeah, right. It's
horseshoe theory.
Yeah.
So but what I think is actually happening is Sargon is still in the year 1964. That's the thing. And so he still has, like, conventional explanations for race differences that they had in 1964. And I mean, if you could probably break it down even further and find out that his views on gender and his views on basically everything are that of a guy from 1964, guy in Britain or the United States. They're going to be pretty close.
So he's pretty much a boomer is what you're saying.
Yeah. He's like, when did the boom? Yeah, I guess so.
Boomer in spirit, maybe.
Yeah. Or something like that. So that's, but what has happened is that there's two groups that understand that the old conventional explanations for race differences have failed totally. And so based on this understanding that the old explanations have failed, you basically have a true dichotomy. There's basically two ways, there's not a third way, there's two ways you can go in explaining the failure of the old conventional explanations for the old conventional environmental explanations for race differences. One way, obviously, is, white privilege, stereotype threat, institutional racism, microaggressions. Like, it's just there in the air. It's ubiquitous, but you can't see it, you can't see it like a fish can't see water. It's just, there's that. direction. That's what is sort of called social justice warrior. Okay, that's the label that's used. And the other is genes.
Right.
And what Sargon is at is he's basically at the point before you realize that the conventional explanations fail. He hasn't even made it to the fork in the road.
It's painful. It's painfully obvious. You can tell he's not, you know, too familiar with, you know, all of the counter arguments to his positions, which are clearly outdated. And to be fair, we have to remember that a lot of these people there is an incentive for them to kind of keep things within a certain niche, for the sake of, you know, the continued flow of shekels and attention. You know, if Sargon went full, 1488, for lack of a better phrase, he would probably lose a substantial portion of his, his listeners and his viewers and so forth. But
it's unfortunate, but so you could say, well, he's sort of predetermined down to continue down the path he's going.
Yeah.
But then again, you could say, well, it's also in our interest to criticize Sargon, so I guess we're all predetermined going down the path we're going. So
Well, ours is rooted in truth, though, so we're definitely a little more legitimate in what we're doing. But
I like to think so.
Yeah.
But let me put it this way: I've heard that song and dance before. You know, we're rooted in truth, and then you know, a few years later, I go, actually. Now this has been a little bit longer than any previous ones, and it has less dangling or lingering concerns, you know, that you just sort of have to ignore.
Right.
Like in any worldview, you know, people tend to come to beliefs and sets. It's not just a random assembly of individual beliefs. They tend to come to various packages and put labels on these packages, progressive, liberal, whatever. And in every package, there's always some weaknesses, some stuff that you can't explain. In libertarian, there's always some issues, you know, but you sort of think, well, we don't have answers to that, but we have stuff that fits really well. You know, we have a whole bunch of beliefs that really fit with each other, and I'm not going to abandon all of this just because there's a few questions I can't answer.
Yeah, so recently over at the Alternative Hypothesis, you've been writing about what you refer to as first worldism. What exactly does that mean?
Okay, short answer, long answer. Short answer is you advocate first world policies and genetics. The long answer is that you can't separate the two. And so it's a conflation. It's a conflation of policy and genetics, and that's kind of the point. The point is that they are intertwined. And I think that's basically a problem that people have when they say they want to bring in a whole bunch of immigrant groups, is they say, we want to bring in all these people, but we have X, Y, or Z policies. And there's a lot of differences in policies. You know, people say, like, I'm a libertarian, or I'm a progressive, or I'm whatever, within a country like Germany or France. But all of these things, like, they're all fundamentally in favor of, like, the consistent rule of law, right? They all believe in, you know, they all have a general support for free speech. Like, you know, what they'll say is they say, I am a quote-unquote socialist, whatever that means. But they'll always say, but I want people to be able to criticize what I think and all that stuff. That's not true. And I'm not just saying this this doesn't come out of my ass. There's survey data on this. And of course, there's the policies of these various countries. That's not true in the Middle East or Africa. It's kind of true in Latin America, oddly enough. They tend to support free speech quite a bit, and their governments have policies to back that up. So, kudos to Latin America. But Africa, Middle East, India, Southeast Asia, China definitely, Japan, these people don't support, for example, free speech. And so basically supporting free speech, that's a first world idea. First world, now for free speech, it is a first world and Latin American idea. So, but then you say, well, most white people tend to be kind of libertarian. What a lot of people will do to counteract this is they'll say, well, look, the government as a percentage of GDP on the continent of Africa is lower than that in Sweden, which is true, But one thing to remember is that the per capita GDP for the continent of Africa is like $1,800. If you had a 50% effective tax rate on the continent of Africa, you know, two-thirds of the population would die.
Right.
So it's kind of like when people point to like the Middle Ages and say, hey, government was pretty small back then. It's like, well, yeah, because basically you're taking, you know, you're taking one of their bowls of porridge every month from them, you know. But anyway, right. So, but basically, they support government as big as they can get away with, as big as they possibly can, right? And this is what you see, for example, in cities with a large black population or a large Amerindian population. So Latin America is actually good on free speech. They're not good on government, and they're not good on the on having consistent law and a lack of regulation. And the reason for that is not because, like, it's not because they want, you know, Byzantine regulations. You know, if you ask a bunch of black and Hispanics, do you really want it to take, you know, a month to start a business in California? They would all say no. Like,
right.
It's not that they support that, but it doesn't matter because they're not voting for that. They're voting based on the Gibbs Medats, and on racial identity.
Yep.
So, and if that's all you're voting on, then the party that one identifies with your racial group and promises the Gibbs, they are going to get all of your votes, and they don't have to do anything to deal with regulations. And dealing with regulations is kind of difficult for politicians to do because they wrote those regulations, they have business interests that want those regulations, they have labor interests that want those regulations. They have lawyer friends who make money enforcing and dealing with those regulations. So there's a lot of sort of internal, I mean, to kind of use a currently overused term, deep state, to continue to have regulations. It's not that the blacks and Hispanics want those regulations. They don't, but they don't vote against them because they're so focused, because they're totally focused on, like, you'll ask them, it's like, yeah, again, I'm against that, but I'm voting for so-and-so because he promised, you know, more, he promised more unemployment benefits, promised an expansion of Section 8, he's promised, you know.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, too, is that, you could ask them on the street if they're against, you know, a massive bureaucracy, if they're against, you know, certain, you know, regulations that would, you know, kind of proved to be a hassle for them in a hypothetical situation like the business one that you offered. But I think, yeah, when it really comes down to it, how against that are they? When you're asking them that, they're probably just like, huh, that sounds like
bad.
It'd be a headache. That sounds like, yeah, I don't want to deal with that. But compare
that to the taxed enough already party.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really, they're not really that against it, and they're more than, you know, whatever reservations they might have against, you know, such things. They're gonna vote for their ethnic group. They're gonna vote for the party that tells them they're victims, and they're gonna vote for the party that you know, most importantly, gives them free stuff.
Right. So, and that's what you get with those kinds of people. And another thing about the term first worldism is actually I first started off with thinking about another term to use instead of the left, okay? Because like when someone says that they're on the left, what does that mean? You know, and someone could say, well, it means lots of things. It means you care about the environment, you know. And it's like, well, sure, like, yeah, they'll say they care about the environment, but so do people who call themselves conservatives and Republicans. They'll tell you they care about the environment, but what conservatives and Republicans will tell you is that there are things that, you know, that are sometimes more important than, you know, there's a cost-benefit sort of trade-off thing.
Right.
But people who call themselves the left, like, they'll do the exact same thing, right? You know, sure, I care about the environment, but mass importation of Africans is more important. You know, mass importations of you know, refugees from Syria. Apparently, Syria stretches from Morocco to Afghanistan. Mass importation of these people, that takes precedent over environmentalism. So, to what extent is the left, quote unquote, even more environmentalist than the quote unquote right? Like, because everybody, like, if they could press a button and just have, like, end all pollution for free, like everyone would press that button, right? But there's trade-offs, right? And both, what is called, quote-unquote, the left and what is called, quote-unquote, the right are willing to make certain trade-offs on the environment. Anti-religionism, people on the left will say, well, I'm sort of against religion, but not when it comes to Islam, not when it comes to religions that non-whites like to practice.
Of course.
Even getting to the point, there's even, I wish I was a little bit more prepared. I could hunt it down and found the articles, but I recall from my memory that there was some article bashing atheists, because a bunch of atheists would attack Christianity, which is okay until you start bringing in a bunch of Hispanic Catholics.
Right.
Now you're attacking their religion. so now are they even anti-religion anymore? So I'm going to go even further. One thing people will say, well, certainly they may not be environmentalists, they may not be consistently anti-religion. Honestly, one thing you could say is that they're consistently pro-big government. That's true. There may be a quote-unquote left-right divide in terms of big government. That's, I think, only true for the U.S. I don't think that's true anywhere else. And the reason it's true in the U.S. is because, founding father libertarianism is part of the, ethno-religion of the United States, right? That's the only reason it's part of the quote-unquote right in the United States. But anyway, but everywhere else, it's not, like, even support or opposition to big government is kind of, like, not a big distinguishing trait between the left and the right, quote-unquote. And even multiracialism, because you'll say, well, certainly they're for multiracialists. Certainly that is the one thing that is consistent about the left, is that they are consistent multiracialists. But that's not even true, because they'll protest mass Chinese immigration to Tibet, to a lesser extent, the other sort of desert republics in China. They'll protest the Israeli settlements in Palestine. Okay. What else is funny is that if you look at the Nuremberg tribunals, one thing that they like to do, one thing that the prosecution's brought up as an atrocity, and I'm not here to say whether or not any of this is true or false. I'm just saying they brought it up sort of as something that is horrible. Was that Germany's supposed plans for Poland, which is that this is where they were going to dump all the political undesirables. They were going to send all the gypsies. They were going to send all the Jews into Poland. And they said, oh, what a horrible crime. Poland is going to be full of gypsies, Jews, and communists. It's like, but of course, what is, Merkel trying to do to Germany today? What was a war crime back then is ox normal for, EU immigration policy today.
Right.
So there's nothing consistent. So that's one thing that I was sort of racking my brain about. It's like, what is the left? It's not big government. It's not the environment. It's not anti-religionism. It's not even multiracialism. So what is it? But when you break everything down, the pattern I finally came to see is that they support everything third world against first world. Right, that's where you find the consistency.
Yep.
Okay. So you think so? The idea that they're anti-religious. Well, that's only in context. That's only in the context of whites. That's only in the context of the religions that white people have. Right. As soon as you start getting brown people, they're not anti-religious anymore. They're environmentalists. Yeah, kind of like everyone's environmentalist until it starts costing them things.
Right? Yeah, or they're pro women's rights until they start importing.
Until they start importing
Islamic people from the Middle East who are the least supportive of these things. Yeah, I've always seen the left, well, not always, but I understand the left as being, there's a good, I believe there's a T.S. Eliot quote about the left being understood as something, as moving away from something rather towards something. They're not looking to establish like these, like permanent principles that they'll stand by within any context, whereas, conservatives are notorious for doing that. The small government, regardless of, you know, free speech, even if it means people coming in and, you know, killing everyone, you know, instituting policies that end up, you know, killing everyone who supports free speech. But, yeah, I really do see the left as every position that it has is just, is for a strategic purpose, which, you know, in your terms would be for, you know, supporting third world policies and attacking, you know, what it sees as the first world, the rights, white people, and so forth.
Right. And so, but because of that, I mean, this may be, I had some success in the past, a very limited amount of success in the past, where I managed to get sort of a small group of people to stop using the term anarchism and start using the term anti-statism, because anarchism, there's a big debate over what is anarchism. Don't need to go down to that. Kind of like there's a debate over what is the alt-right.
Right.
So, but, you know, but what I, and so I had a little bit of success, and I'm thinking, oh, how good would it be if instead of calling them the left, because you call them the left and people's minds fill in the blanks. And their minds are filled in the blanks. It's like, oh, the left. That means yoga and kombucha. Oh, I like those things. You know,
right.
I like the left.
Right.
You know, now, but the thing is, like, when I say the left, I don't, like when I say the left, I don't want other people's brains to start to just, you know, to that,
fill in
for,
the
that
brains,
for that
yeah.
to be like a little wild card that they get to put whatever they want in there. No, when I say the left, I mean advocates of third world genetics and policies.
Yeah. Okay. And advocates who are willing to resort to, violence in many cases, in order to, you know, pretty much oppress us with their third world genetics and policies. So,
right.
Yeah, it's really, I do really like that because so many people, when they think of the left, like you said, it's, you know, Starbucks, yoga pants and so forth, but, yeah, many of them just see it as this like feel good thing. It's about being compassionate. It's you know, it's obviously a very feminine appeal.
No, it's about poo in the loo. No,
right. Well, I mean, that's the logical conclusion. It's
right.
We see that in San Francisco, people defecating in the streets, which is a distinctly third world phenomenon. So you know, it's definitely creeping in.
To be, okay. In fairness, when Europe was super poor, they also shat in the streets, but that's not.
that didn't happen as far as
I just sort of said that as kind of a joke, not as some grand philosophical claim. About
right.
Anyway.
I mean, that does happen quite a bit in the third world these days, though. So let's. But continue.
Okay, so I think that's basically why I sort of had first worldism.
Okay.
It was a new term, and anyway, but basically, it was third worldism. I came to say they're not leftists; they're third worldists. Okay, well, what am I? You know, obviously, first worldists.
Right.
And it's also what was funny. This is a little bit of a tangent. Is that there's a few people who I know who said I don't like the term first worldist because it sounds like. A political philosophy note called Maoist third worldism. And we all know about that in our little group, but I was like, nobody knows about Maoist third worldism. And also, like, who cares? Like, nobody in China is a Maoist third worldist anymore. Like, that's
right.
So, but anyway, sorry, that's a bit of a tangent.
No, yeah, and that reminds me of, that's definitely not nearly as bad as, say, you know, Paul Joseph Watson and Mike Cernovich referring to themselves as the new right. Yet they're unaware that, you know, the new right has already been in existence in Europe for many years and so forth. But, yeah, awesome. Well, Ryan, we still have a lot more to cover, but I think now would be a good time to take a break. But before we do that, why don't you tell everyone where they can find your work, maybe if you have any, you know, if you're on Twitter and so forth.
Yeah, website is thealternativehypothesis.org. The Twitter is thealthype. You can find links to the Twitter, the Facebook page, and the YouTube on the right hand side of the site where it says social media. And yeah, bye.
All right, awesome. Well, sit tight, folks. We'll be back for the members hour in just a minute.